A Depraved Coward, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo calls the suspect in yesterday's vehicle attack in Manhattan a depraved coward. Authorities say he's Saifullo Saipov, a 29-year-old Uzbek national.
Uzbekistan is one of the former Soviet republics, and we know the former Soviet republics are actually the region of the world that has sent the most foreign fighters to join Islamic State in Iraq and Syria.
Also, one expert's analysis of the way President Trump responds to terror attacks.
What Donald Trump has done consistently in terror attacks, both abroad and here in the United States, is used it as a means to essentially divide us from them.
So who is them? That and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We will not be intimidated. We will investigate. The kind of things you hear from a country's political leaders right after a terror attack. We heard statements like that yesterday from officials in New York. President Trump's reaction to the vehicle attack in Manhattan has been different. He did offer his prayers and condolences to the victims and families, but he came down hard on the U.S. justice system, saying we need quicker justice and tougher punishment in terror cases. And he said this.
I'm going to ask Congress to immediately initiate work to get rid of this program, diversity and diversity lottery. Diversity lottery sounds nice. It's not nice. It's not good.
Trump said that because a suspect, 29-year-old Saifullo Saipov from Uzbekistan, entered the U.S. legally in 2010 through the so-called diversity visa program. Trump also said he would consider sending the suspect to Guantanamo. I asked Julia Kayyem for her reaction to that idea. She's a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security.
Under what grounds, right? I mean, we have jurisdiction. The courts of the United States have jurisdiction over a terror case here in the United States. And so there's no jurisdiction, just to be technical about it, for Trump to send him to Guantanamo Bay. But that's not – Trump likely knows that. And what Donald Trump has done consistently in terror attacks, both abroad and here in the United States, is used it as a means to essentially divide us from them, however he wants to define us. And he's done that consistently this morning.
So let's talk for a moment about the choice of weapon here, a vehicle, in this case, a rented pickup truck. ISIS has encouraged vehicle attacks, correct?
Yes, absolutely. So as the, you know, as ISIS has struggled, in fact, failed now in capturing more land in Syria and Iraq, they have been for the last year sort of motivating those who are either tied to ISIS or who might be motivated by ISIS to use rudimentary tools to kill civilians, to activate terrorism. And there was some chatter online, at least not ISIS central, but those affiliated with ISIS about, you know, sort of ramping up in the wake of Halloween. But we still don't know if Saipov was directed, was passive. We just don't know right now. I will say one thing. He's been here since 2010. So if the United States thinks that this is an international problem, it's going to miss the mark. He has been here since 2010 with what we can tell so far. No sort of touch points to the FBI, to counterterrorism, and intelligence agents, that this was a man who was able to rent a van because he was under the radar, and that he may have very quietly radicalized until he sort of showed himself yesterday.
So back to how Saipov came to the U.S.
Yeah.
He came here in 2010 under the visa lottery scheme, also known as a diversity visa. President Trump's made a point of arguing for scrapping the diversity visas, but presumably people who get those visas are vetted really carefully before coming to the States like everybody else,
I think that's so important for you to say, because we tend to think of, well, if there's the system, then they're in. All the system does, whether it's the diversity system, the family member system, whatever, or a student visa, all it does is make someone eligible for entry. So it just means that you can get into the line. The line still exists, right? There's still a vetting process. There's still a review, making sure that you know, the reasons that you're coming are valid, that there are in fact family members here. And so, you know, think about it in terms of marriage, right? You can't just say, You can't say, look, I want to get a green card because I'm getting married to an American. That doesn't mean that there's not a process to ensure that actually you're telling the truth. And the same is true of all of these programs. The diversity program was obviously a way for the United States to rethink its focus on certain classes of immigrants who were coming in here lawfully. So it would actually add or increase quotas for countries that were underrepresented in a United States that's just much more diverse than it was when Western Europeans seemed like the only acceptable immigrants coming into the United States.
That was Juliette Kayyem, former assistant secretary with the Department of Homeland Security. As I mentioned earlier, the suspect, Saifullo Saipov, immigrated to the U.S. legally in 2010 from Uzbekistan.
As soon as I heard that, my ears perked up.
That's New York Times correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki.
Uzbekistan is one of the former Soviet republics, and we know from a recent Zufan Group report that the former Soviet republics are actually the region of the world that has sent the most foreign fighters to join the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. That doesn't mean that this person by any means went and fought for the group in Iraq and Syria, but it does mean that he comes from a country that has had a large share of people join this group.
So what have you seen online, specifically in pro-ISIS channels, as far as claims of responsibility and just generally about this attack, what people are saying?
So there is no claim of responsibility for this attack from any official ISIS media outlet. That doesn't surprise me. In general, ISIS has not claimed attacks when the perpetrator is in custody or is on the run. For example, during the Paris attacks, there were 10 attackers. ISIS claimed all of them, except for Salah Abdeslam, who's the only one who got caught. So that's the first thing to say. However, in the larger ecosystem online that ISIS functions in, their supporters and fans are going crazy with this attack. They're posting really every couple of minutes. I was just going through the channels now. They've made commemorative posters celebrating the attack, showing things like the Statue of Liberty with cracks up and down its foundation as if it's about to fall apart. And interestingly, we don't know if this is connected, but just a day before the attack, on October 30th, an important pro-ISIS outlet called the An-Nour Centre Médiatique, it's a French media platform for the Islamic State, put out a poster calling for attacks on Halloween. And it was an unusual poster because it was translated into numerous languages, Russian, in French, in German, and in English. And it included October 31st, the date, very prominently in the font on the banner.
Do we know if Saipov has spent any time online looking at ISIS channels or even ISIS allied channels?
We don't. And that's one of the key things that I'm waiting for officials to comment on. They very quickly came out and said that this is not part of a larger conspiracy, that they don't seem to believe that anybody else is involved. I'm always skeptical when I hear officials say these things so declaratively in the first hours after an investigation. The only way to know if he's connected to other people is if they have scrubbed his electronics, if they've gotten his phone, if they've gotten his laptop, and they've gone not just through the traffic that is readily available, but whatever he might have used on encrypted platforms, and also what he might have erased. So, for example, with many of the attackers in Europe, we saw that they attempted to erase chats. And experts at the DGSI in Paris or at other intelligence
agencies, that's their Secret Service.
That's their Secret Service, yes, were in some instances able to recuperate the deleted chats and deleted traffic, which led them to make different conclusions than they would have otherwise.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the NYPD's conclusion that this was an act of terrorism because it happened very shortly after the attack. Do you think they had all the evidence they needed to go out and make that claim? And it was less than 2 hours after the attack to make that determination.
Well, what we do know is that they found a note either inside the car or near the car where he allegedly pledges allegiance to the Islamic State. That is very telling. I'm very curious to see what type of terminology he used. The terms that he used are going to tell us to what extent he was radicalized and to what extent he was steeped in their ideology. But if I was in their shoes and I would have found that note, and we know the mode of attack that he used, and we know that he was screaming Allah Akbar, according to witnesses, that does start to look like a politically motivated act of violence.
Finally, Rukmini, what are you going to be looking for as the day goes on and the next few days unfold?
I'm really eager to get the note. I'm looking to see what type of terms he used in the note. ISIS has their own lingo in terms of how you're supposed to pledge allegiance to the group. They will take an allegiance from anyone. But if he uses the terminology that I'll be looking for, it will show a greater degree of knowledge of their propaganda. That's the first thing. The second thing is I'm very curious to know whether authorities have recovered his electronics and what they have found on it. That is where we expect to see evidence of a digital connection to ISIS, and specifically whether this was remotely guided by ISIS online.
Rukmini, it is always good to get your take. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
New York Times correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki there. Tensions are still high in Kenya after last week's presidential election rerun. President Uhuru Kenyatta has now been declared the winner with 98% of the vote. It is that high because challenger Raila Odinga boycotted the balloting, arguing it would not be free and fair. He said that about the original vote, too, by the way. All of which has left many Kenyans worried about a return to the sort of post-election violence that tore Kenya apart a decade ago. Boniface Mwangi is an anti-corruption campaigner in Nairobi, and he joined us here in our Boston studio.
Kenya's on the brink of chaos. There's a lot of tension in the country, so there's fears that the country is going to burn or we may go back to what happened 10 years ago. If you look at the killings in the country so far, about 70-plus people have died since the elections. Most of the killings have been done by the police. Mm-hmm. The police have been using live bullets to disperse peaceful protests.
You've been out on the street, Boniface. Tell us what happened to you about 2 weeks ago during a demonstration.
I went to protest against police violence, against peaceful protests, and I got shot with a tear gas canister.
By the police?
I was shot by the police.
So the narrative that we typically read or hear about is that Kenyans are deeply polarized along ethnic lines. Luo, Kikuyu, President Uhuru Kenyatta, he can count on support from the large Kikuyu ethnic community. Raila Odinga has the support of the Luos. Is this ethnic divide just too simplistic to try to understand what's going on in Kenya?
It's the reality. The people who run our country, Raila Odinga, Uhuru Kenyatta, are not ideological leaders. They are tribal kingpins. Raila is the king of the Luos, and Uhuru is the king of the Kikuyus. And for them to win, they do tribal alliances. They do not get people together based on ideology and say, this is our values. They form coalitions on tribal lines. So the state of the nation is actually goes back to colonial Kenya, where the British divided Kenyans along tribal lines to be able to conquer them. And then the leaders who came into power, the people who run our country, realized that the best way to divide people and rule over them is using tribe.
The whole notion of identity by tribe, tribal identity, I know it's weighed heavily on you personally. You
yes.
even kind of struggle about naming your children and what to name them. I'm wondering if you could just talk about that.
So my wife and I made up our minds a long time ago, even before we got married, that we give our kids different names. Because in Kenya, so if I say my name is Mwangi, you know that I'm Kikuyu. So we said we are going to give our kids names that are different from our community.
Mm.
So we gave our firstborn as a Zulu name, Simpiwe.
South African.
Yes. Our secondborn has an Arabic name, Naila.
Mm.
Then our lastborn has a Luo name. So I have a Kikuyu child in my house, but his name is Mboya. I gave him a Luo name. Because I want to fight tribalism by leading by example, because if you don't do that, then you don't have a country. And I think the tragedy of my country, and this breaks my heart a lot, is that there's so many young people who don't speak their mother tongue, but because there's a lack of a national identity, they go back to their tribal identity. So as a country, we need to forge a national identity that is based on values, no tribe.
How do your kids feel about that? Because, yeah, you're leading by example, but they're the ones out on the street with the name.
So the kids are too young to understand this tribal nonsense. But I hope that I'm going to fight tribalism with other people. By the time they're old enough, it won't matter what tribe they are or what is the name. They'll be judged by their character and their morals, not their last name.
How many Kenyans are there like you who are really kind of thirsting, hungering for a leader who can provide for the people, create something for the people, and not just kind of locked in this decades-long cycle of ethnic rivalries?
We are the minority. Our message is not mainstream yet. It's a very small green movement. So we are not yet mainstream, but you have to start somewhere. So
right.
We have to change our country by being the change we want to see, even if it's not popular.
Boniface Mwangi, Kenyan photojournalist and anti-corruption campaigner and a great activist in the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Telling the story of Australia's stolen generations through poetry. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We don't often hear from Australia's Aboriginal communities, but we will today, twice, now and later in the show. First, Yale University has an award for excellence in writing, the Wyndham Campbell Literary Prize. And this year, Ali Cobby Eckerman became the first Australian Aboriginal to win it. Eckerman writes a lot about her difficult childhood and how it's impacted her life. It's an experience she has shared with many thousands of Aboriginal children. Jasmine Garst with our Women's Lives desk explains.
When Ali Cobby Eckerman was a teenager, she ran away to the desert in central Australia.
It was either running away to the desert or prison because I was starting to get into a lot of trouble. And I left because I didn't want to see the hurt in my adopted parents' eyes.
Eckerman was born in the 1960s. She's from what is known as the Stolen Generations. An estimated 100,000 Aboriginal children were removed from their biological families by the Australian government and sent to boarding schools and church-run missions. This took place throughout the late 19th and 20th centuries. Here's a snippet of a poem Eckerman wrote for the mother she was taken from. She read it on Australian Public Radio.
My mother is a granite boulder. I can no longer climb nor walk around. Her weight is a constant reminder of myself. I sit in her shadow.
Eckerman was adopted into a family of white farmers in southern Australia. She says they were so kind to her, but there were larger, looming issues they could not shield her away from. She was sexually assaulted by a family friend. And as an Aboriginal child growing up in a white community, she was bullied. By the time she was a teen, the alienation was unbearable. She'd spiraled into alcoholism and drug addiction. At 18, she gave birth to a boy. A single mom, she felt judged by the people in her community. She put the baby up for adoption and left for Central Australia to find her birth family. She says, out there, she learned to honor her own grief. The pain of everything that had happened to her and to the women who came before her.
You have to honor it and you have to feel it and it hurts. And people will stop at a level of pain. That's where they become stuck. You have to allow yourself to feel every iota of it to get to the other side. My poetry came out of honoring my grief.
Eckerman was able to reunite with her mother. She describes it with a sweet sadness. So many of the Stolen Generations never even got that. But Eckerman and her mom, they missed out on an entire life together. Her mother's death led to the poetry book Inside My Mother.
My mother screams as I touch her hair, attempting to brush away the coarseness with my hands, to entwine twigs filled with leaves into her locks. A tiara of green to soften her face.
I asked her if her adoptive mother, the woman who raised her, Frida, has read her poems, and how does she feel about them?
It really is sad now to see Mum's concern that I identify as a Stolen Generation person. Because in her heart, she wasn't stealing anything. She was offering a home to children that she was told weren't wanted. That's our common bond, is that Mum Frida was tricked into believing something that wasn't true. And my own birth mother was tricked out of keeping her firstborn child, which was me.
Eckerman has been able to break that cycle. She has a relationship with her firstborn son, the boy she gave up for adoption. He's a grown man now, and they've reunited.
Today I found a broken house, its windows blank and mouth askew. Yet in the tangled rusty mess, gems of sentiment linger. Today I became a weeping tree, a vision of memory deep inside. A face embedded in its bark, the mirror of my mum.
The Wyndham Campbell Award includes a $165,000 prize. Eckerman says this gives her a chance to build a home for herself and the family she's finally reunited with. For The World, I'm Jasmine Garst.
Our next story focuses on another controversy involving the Australian government. It's about one of the offshore detention centers it runs for migrants. Yesterday, following a court order, Australia closed the Manus Island camp in Papua New Guinea. But about 600 asylum seekers there are refusing to leave. They say it's not safe to do so. Meanwhile, the power lines have been cut, there's no running water, and they're running out of food. The World's Carol Hills is with me to talk about all this. What is going on here, Carol?
Well, Marco, this overseas camp on Manus Island, it's in Papua New Guinea. It was one of these camps set up by Australia to divert asylum seekers arriving by boat. They simply won't let them even be processed in Australia. And as of yesterday, Australia shut down the camp. These 600 men are inside this camp. They refuse to leave. There's no power. They don't feel safe in the neighboring town. They're running out of food, and they are just hunkering down.
Didn't the U.S. agree to resettle these asylum seekers? What's the American obligation to them?
The U.S. is the complete linchpin. The Obama administration struck an agreement with Australia in the waning days of its term to take up to 1,250 of these asylum seekers. Trump didn't like the agreement, but has eventually agreed to honor it. The UN High Commission for Refugees is in charge of administering the agreement, but it's taking lots of time. Apparently, 50 asylum seekers have been accepted, but it's going to take a long time, and we're not sure how many the U.S. will accept in the long run.
This is Australia's policy, though. I mean, isn't Australia obliged to assure the safety of the men who remain in this camp, who won't leave?
Many, many Australians agree with that. There's a Green Party senator, Nick McKim. He's on Manus Island now. He's furious. He's called Peter Dutton, the immigration and border minister for the government, a racist. I mean, this whole thing has really gotten out of hand. And Australia's Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, he's in Israel right now on a trip. So there's an acting prime minister in charge in Australia.
Wow. So you've actually reported on a couple of the asylum seekers who are in this camp. Are they in this group of 600 that refuse to leave?
One of the people I interviewed, Eaton Fish, he's a cartoonist. He's from Iran, and he's been at this camp for 4 years. He struggles from a lot of mental health problems, which many of the detainees suffer from as well. He apparently is not at the camp. He's being treated in Port Moresby, the capital of Papua New Guinea. But Abdulaziz, another person that I profiled, he is one of the asylum seekers who refuses to leave this camp. He's also been at this camp for 4 years. He has refugee status. He's one of the ones who refuses to leave.
So who's covering this on Manus? Who's on the ground? Any media?
Well, up to now, the media has been really kept away, but the Australian Broadcasting Corporation is there. And also, The Guardian is relying on one of the detainees himself, an Iranian journalist, Behrouz Bouchani. He is stuck as a detainee, and he has been for many years. The Guardian is using him for coverage, and he's tweeting out what's happening, and so it's a really interesting situation.
We'll wait to see what happens next. The World's Carol Hills on the humanitarian crisis at one of Australia's offshore detention camps on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. Thanks for the update, Carol.
Thanks, Marco.
News headlines are next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tech and social media giants are on Capitol Hill answering tough questions about Russian meddling in the U.S. elections. They may have to admit, though, that they're out of their league.
It would be hard to imagine the kind of United Nations scale of issues that they have to deal with. You need your own State Department.
That story is still ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You know, for a show like ours that aims to make connections between in here and out there, Russian hacking, what can I say? It's unfortunately the gift that keeps on giving. There are still a lot of questions about how social media platforms were used by Russian operatives as part of a larger plot to interfere with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. And this week, U.S. officials are putting some of those questions directly to Google, Facebook, and Twitter in a series of congressional hearings. Here's Senator Al Franken, Democrat from Minnesota, asking the companies why they allowed Russians to purchase ads on their platforms.
You put billions of data points together all the time. That's what I hear that these platforms do. They're the most sophisticated things invented by man ever. Google has all knowledge that man has ever developed. You can't put together rubles with a political ad and go like, those two data points spell out something bad.
The World's Lydia Emanuelidou joins me in the studio. So what have we learned from these hearings so far?
So the big takeaway so far is that the reach of this Russia-linked content is much, much wider than we previously thought. So on Facebook, for example, Facebook had said that paid ads had reached about 10 million people. Today, they said that number is actually closer to 150 million people, that 150 million people in the U.S. saw content that was created by these Russia-linked actors.
Wow, what a huge difference, 140 million difference. So what exactly was the content?
So a lot of it started with targeted ads, and those ads were paid for by the Internet Research Agency. That's this St. Petersburg troll farm that has links to the Kremlin. And the goal of the ads was really to lure social media users to like and to follow the pages that the ads were coming from. And that way, these pages were able to build huge followings with hundreds of thousands of followers.
So what were these pages? Like, what was the Internet Research Agency making up?
We've actually heard about some of them here on The World before. There were pages about really socially divisive issues here in the U.S. So gun rights, immigration rights, civil rights. And, you know, the intent here was to create division. And actually, one great example of this came up at today's hearing. These Russian trolls created two groups on Facebook. So there was the Heart of Texas, and that page was promoting anti-immigration and anti-Muslim views. Another page these Russian trolls created was the United Muslims of America. And not only were they able to reach hundreds of thousands of people through those pages, but they actually got people to come out and protest together. And these were people on opposing sides of an issue. And here's Senator Richard Burr. He's the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the hearing today, describing what happened.
Establishing these two competing groups, paying for the ads, and causing this disruptive event in Houston cost Russia about $200. And Mr. Stretch, you commented yesterday that your company's goal is bringing people together. In this case, people were brought together to foment conflict, and Facebook enabled that event to happen. I would say that Facebook has failed their goal.
Wow, two fake groups, the Heart of Texas, United Muslims of America. It's kind of surreal. What are companies doing, Lydia, to prevent this from happening in the future?
So a lot of the efforts that they announced are focused on ad transparency. And so when an advertiser reaches out to you, these companies want to be more transparent about where that ad is coming from, who's paying for it, and why you're being targeted. But, you know, a lot of senators on these committees and also a lot of outside experts think that's not really enough. And here's what Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democratic senator from California, had to say.
I must say, I don't think you get it. What we're talking about is the beginning of cyber warfare. What we're talking about is a major foreign power with the sophistication and ability to involve themselves in a presidential election and sow conflict and discontent all over this country. We are not going to go away, gentlemen. You've created these platforms, and now they are being misused. And you have to be the ones to do something about it.
So, Lydia, did we get a better sense of whether any of this affected the outcome of the election last year?
No, that's still a big question that these tech company representatives weren't really willing to answer very clearly. But again, we did hear today that these companies seem to agree that this goes far beyond this one election here in the U.S. and that the goal was to shake up the political climate here.
The World's Lydia Emanuelidou, thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
I want you to hear one more excerpt from yesterday's Senate Judiciary hearing on all this. This is Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy pointing out that the stakes when it comes to the spread of false information are especially high in young democracies.
Facebook's fastest growing markets are in the developing world. Now, there, consequences of spreading fake or divisive information can be dire. It's not just an election. It's people's lives.
One place where we see this happening is Myanmar, where some say misinformation is helping fuel violence against the Rohingya ethnic group. Paul Mosier is a New York Times technology reporter based in Asia. How widespread is Facebook in Myanmar, first of all, Paul?
It is completely ubiquitous. If you kind of think about it, the entire internet is Facebook, and Facebook is the internet. Most people don't necessarily know how to operate or get on and navigate regular websites. They kind of live, eat, sleep, and breathe Facebook.
So among all those many users, who's using Facebook to spread misinformation, and what are the kinds of things people are posting?
So we see misinformation on both sides, both supporters of the Rohingya and Buddhist nationalists. But in particular, the ones that seem the most problematic are government channels, which have put a lot of propaganda out there, saying everything from, you know, the Rohingya are burning their own villages to, you know, showing bodies of soldiers who may be from other conflicts on saying that this is the result of a Rohingya attack, to more nuanced stuff like calling the Rohingya Bengalis and saying that they don't belong in the country.
What kind of reaction do those posts get from the public at large?
A lot of these guys, you know, we're out to the monk who's been banned from preaching in Myanmar because he tends to sort of whip up this nationalist fervor, has, you know, hundreds of thousands of followers, and any kind of post like this gets widely shared. You know, people believe it and they, you know, sort of spill the bile underneath it, kind of arguing that this is the problem with these people and, you know, we should drive them out. So it's very obviously effective.
Does Facebook already have a policy and procedure for identifying and taking down hate speech? And does that process work better with, say, identifying things like swastikas and white nationalism than with slurs against the Rohingya?
They have community standards, and these generally apply to all manner of hate speech. The problem is kind of contextualizing it, and I think there's a sort of Western centrism to how Facebook polices these things. This is a company that is largely employs English speakers in America. So the idea that they're going to sort of be parsing Burmese and sort of be able to surf the cultural currents to understand what is hate speech and what isn't and what's real and what's not sort of stretches belief. But they also, you know, haven't done a lot to really sort of further that aim. There's not a huge Facebook presence in Burma. You know, a lot of the people that have really set up stuff to disprove fake news are freelancers or small kind of nonprofit organizations. It's not as if Facebook has kind of come in and taken a lead. It's needed these other people to help them. So it's almost as if they've outsourced that oversight to local groups who are clearly underfunded and don't have the resources to do it.
So when Senator Leahy of Vermont brought up this issue, his interlocutor didn't really have an answer for him.
You're monetizing information from users in the developing world, but what are you doing to make sure it's not used to undermine nascent democracies, especially in the undermining? It's not losing votes, it's losing lives.
It's really an excellent point and a very challenging topic. We view our platform as a vehicle for providing greater visibility into what's going on around the world and greater visibility into human rights abuses. Now, we do have an obligation to make sure that it is not misused. And the way
we're talking about lives.
So what do you think of that non-response? And as a technology reporter, what do you think Facebook should be doing?
It's such a complicated issue when you start taking in the kind of, it's almost Tower of Babel extent of the languages and cultures that are communicating on Facebook. But I mean, certainly, I think the idea is that you have to do a lot better and invest a lot more. I mean, if you have something, you know, a humanitarian crisis on the order of what's happening with the Rohingya, and your platform is being used as a tool to propagate that or help encourage that, the fact that other nonprofits and other organizations that don't have the sort of financial might and the profit power that you have are the ones taking the lead just seems to me to be surprising.
Do you think Facebook even considered these dilemmas when they first went to a place like Myanmar or when they even started up as a company?
I mean, certainly not when they started up as a company, right? I mean, it would be hard to imagine from, say, a Harvard dorm room, the kind of United Nations scale of issues that they have to deal with, right? I mean, it's bewildering. You need your own State Department to kind of handle the amount of stuff that's going on Facebook. I mean, it has 2 billion people. Languages are everywhere. I was just in Ecuador a couple weeks ago, and, you know, small towns in the Andes, and everybody is sharing all of their news on Facebook. So, I mean, it's just every corner of the world. And that just creates a bewildering set of conflicts and problems and issues that are going to crop up. And there's some hard thinking needs to be done. And I'm kind of glad I'm a journalist and not the one having to make some of those calls, you know. But yeah.
Paul Mosier is the New York Times technology reporter based in Shanghai. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thanks.
Okay, the words endangered species might make you think of tigers and panda bears, fair enough. But environmental regulations also protect endangered trees, and that can impact the kind of wood used to make everything from kitchen tables to paper plates. The world's Daniel Gross wanted to know how these laws are enforced. So he visited a country that's cracked down on the trade in protected wood, Germany.
Gerald Koch describes himself as a wood detective. That's what it says on his office door at the Thunen Institute of Wood Research in Hamburg. To see his detective work in action, I ask him to look at one wood sample under a microscope. Without looking at the label, I want him to tell me the type of tree it came from.
Yes. We have a very typical parenchyma bends, and the parenchyma bends...
It doesn't take long to find a clue. Little stripes called resin canals, common in certain species of evergreen trees.
So it took you, a few seconds to identify the family?
Yes, right, yes. And now go on the genus level with high root rays. It should be Dipterocarpus of the genus level.
He's right. The label says Dipterocarpus. The whole process takes around 60 seconds. Koch says he's been good with wood since he was a kid. His family worked in the timber industry.
My grandpa started with a sawmill, and directly as a small boy, I go with my family and have to help.
Today, Koch runs a laboratory funded by the German government. It includes a century-old reference library, a dozen shelves crammed not with books, but with 35,000 wood samples. There are even unusual objects, like a perfectly preserved plank from the Egyptian pyramids, and a hunk of rock-hard ebony.
Ebony from Madagascar, strongly protected.
It's so heavy that we can hardly lift it.
Try it. You must take both hands to put it here. Ah, small block, more about 30 kilograms, I think, yes.
Wow, that is heavy.
Yes, very heavy.
So-called wood detectives exist because of international law. For centuries, the buying and selling of rare wood has threatened forests worldwide. To this day, half of Amazon tree species are at risk of extinction. So in 1973, 80 nations signed the CITES Treaty, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. It's now law in 183 nations. Koch's lab helps enforce it. To show me how, he pulls out a guitar that was made in China. His lab chopped it in half to take samples, which they soften in boiling water. Then they cut thin slices and place them under a microscope.
In one guitar, we have identified about 20 different timber from Chinese market. Altogether, this is global market, we say, in one guitar.
Koch's colleagues have even started to study wood byproducts, like charcoal and paper. One scientist, Andrea Olbrich, can identify species by looking at single cells in wood pulp. This week, the lab tested fence posts supposedly made of high-quality chestnut.
We cut it and I make a first observation, it was the wrong timber.
Turns out, it's cheap hazelnut.
Did they use the wrong timber just by mistake?
I think it's a more cheaper. It's a question of money.
Those who sell protected woods have to pay big fines and turn over their products to the police. The laboratory contains dozens of confiscated products, including furniture seized from yard sales and eBay. Not everyone believes that these regulations work. George Grun, a Nashville guitar salesman, says his industry has been paralyzed by regulations on rosewood, a crucial raw material. To sell guitars built decades ago, you now need an expensive permit.
So you can't get wood to make new guitars, and on vintage and used ones, you still can't export them without the bleeping permit.
Grun, who also has a degree in zoology, would prefer a different approach. He thinks that if countries could sustainably make money from trees, they'd want to protect their forests. Gerald Koch of Germany's Thunen Institute feels it's his job to enforce the existing laws. And he thinks it's up to all of us to know where our products come from.
We say in German, Unwissenheit schützt vor Strafe nicht.
So it's like a lack of awareness.
Mm-hmm. Schützt nicht vor Strafe.
Doesn't protect you from punishment or right. Doesn't protect you from consequences.
That's right.
So the next time you spot some vintage wood furniture at a yard sale, be careful. The wood detectives may be watching. For The World, Daniel Gross, Hamburg.
Let's return now to the top story today, that vehicle attack in New York City. Of the 8 people killed, 5 of them were from Argentina, part of a group of 9 friends who were on vacation in the city to celebrate the 30th anniversary of their graduation from a college in the city of Rosario, Argentina. Caroline Stauffer is the Latin America bureau chief for Reuters. She's based in Buenos Aires. What do we know about the victims, Caroline? Where are they from and what did they do?
So this was a group of guys, a group of friends who went to a high school together, a technical high school in the city of Rosario, which is in northern Argentina. And they were celebrating their 30th anniversary of graduating from this school. And this is very common in Argentina, had maintained a very close friendship. We know that they were well-respected members of the community. Some were architects. One ran a steel distribution company. The president, of course, said this morning that they were model citizens. So it's an incredibly sad day for the whole country.
And there were other members of this group nearby when this attack took place, right?
5 were killed and 1 is in the hospital still. The Argentine consulate in New York said this group had decided to rent bicycles. So they were all on a bike trip together. And a couple members of the group were not harmed in the incidents, but the majority of them were, sadly.
Yeah, just wrong place, wrong time. What can you tell us about Rosario, this city in northern Argentina where these men came from?
So this is a city of a little over 1 million people in the north. It's probably best known for soccer star Lionel Messi is from Rosario. It's a very well-known agricultural city. That's the most important industry. It was also the birthplace of Che Guevara, the Cuban revolutionary. The mayor has declared 3 days of mourning. The director of the school, where one of the victims actually had a child going to school, they've also declared a week of mourning and started the school day today with a minute of silence.
How are the people in Argentina reacting to this? What is the mood like?
People are very sad in Argentina. Of course, if you ask people on the street, they'll say they would have been sad for any nationality, but it does hit closer to home, of course, having people from their country. And Argentina has been spared in recent years this kind of violence that we have seen in Europe and most recently in the U.S. But it's a country that does know attacks. There have been, in the past decades, an attack on the Israeli embassy here. An attack also on a Jewish community center. So they still have those memories here.
I mean, as you say, it's been a couple of decades since Argentina saw this kind of violence on its soil. But now in New York City, 5 Argentine victims all at once. How has that actually brought home these kinds of attacks? Do people in Argentina feel they're no longer immune in this borderless world?
I've heard that no one is immune. Doesn't matter your nationality or your beliefs. I haven't heard Argentines saying they'll stop traveling. I think they're kind of people that like to seize life. And are they going to kind of recoil and not travel? That doesn't really strike me as a national sort of way of being. But it is shocking because, again, they haven't seen this sort of thing. And just to have such a large percentage of this tragedy be from really the other side of the world, it's very far away. It really is quite affecting.
I imagine Argentines will be processing this for quite a few days, if not weeks.
Definitely. And there's still things that people don't know. The general consulate in New York gave a press conference, and there's questions about the repatriation of the victims. Some of the family members we think will be traveling to New York to accompany the bodies home. And we know that, of course, Argentina will be following this investigation into the incident very closely to see what, if any, sort of answers they can get. And certainly the mourning will continue.
It is so sad. We really thank you for the view from Argentina. Caroline Stauffer there, bureau chief for Reuters, based in Buenos Aires. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.
Let's wrap things up on a brighter note. The World's Brandy Fullwood joins me for a new segment we're going to be doing together. We're calling it A-Side, B-Side. So, Brandy, how's this going to work?
So this is part of our collaboration with the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, and they have this really extensive collection of songs, of poetry, a lot of narratives that I've been digging through, either traditional or folk most of the time from all over the world. So the A-side is going to be a selection from the Smithsonian.
Right. And as you say, their archive is a crate digger's dream. So a lot to choose from. So your B-side is what?
My B-side is something that I'm picking to complement it. A lot of the time I understand things through comparison or by making playlists that have strongly related themes, ideas, sounds, etc. You can think of it like RIYL or recommended if you like.
Yeah, I just wondered what that meant. So what'd you pick for us this week?
So on the A side, I have Mariah Chant on the tribal music of Australia. I'll just play it right now and talk about it.
So this is Aboriginal. I mean, this is super sparse music.
It's recorded in 1949. Most of what the Smithsonian was able to capture of it, at least with this song, is that the song is about a really simple narrative of flood water going down into the sea slowly, swiftly. But the more important thing about it and how this will eventually relate to the B-side is the way that the songman uses his voice. It's all about keeping the rhythm, having your words convey a rhythm and have this strong focus enunciation, but then also a slurring. So instead of you knowing what the lyrics are, you know what the rhythm of the song is supposed to be.
Right, and knowing kind of the emotion too. So that's Aboriginal music from Australia from an album called Tribal Music of Australia. What is your B-side, Brandy?
For my B-side, I've got Napalm's solo album, Nidapal. She has a couple of tracks on the album that sort of follow the same vocal rhythms of the songmen on the A-side. The Mariah chant is somewhat sonically like Molasses on Napalm's album. There's a lot of vowel runs, stressed syllables, and it tends to be soulful and jazzy in a way that the vocals lead for the rhythm instead of the instrumentals leading the rhythm.
So that's Molasses. It sounds like Molasses. It also sounds a little connected to what we heard before.
Yeah, I definitely agree. That's kind of why I picked it. There are a lot of songs that have a stronger connection to the Mariah chant, but this song relates to the fresh water running down, and molasses tends to run down really slowly, so you get the story of something dripping down and moving really slowly rhythmically of water, but then you also get something moving rhythmically with molasses. So I don't know if she technically used the Mariah chant to go along with the way she created the song, but they are really matching an understanding of using vocals and rhythm as one and the same.
Well, I love your picks and I love this segment. The world's Brandy Fullwood, producer for Future Folk. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Buried in the soil, selfless or die.
I really want to hear more, but we're out of time. Marco Werman here from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.